Iguodala to Curry, back to Iguodala, up for the layup. Oh, blocked by James. LeBron James with the rejection.
Welcome to the Chase Down Podcast on Love to the Chat. I'm your host, Justin Rowe, with my co-host, Carter Rodriguez. Carter, how's it going, man?
It's going good. I was super hungry, had a super late dinner. We're recording about 10 o'clock Central Time. But I ate just a shit ton of General Tso's chicken, so now I want to die. But you've never heard of General Tso's chicken. When I told you that before we started recording, you thought it was a brand?
I'm still convinced it's a brand.
Do like you have...
The General's chicken.
When you get Chinese food in Winnipeg... What are your standards at a standard like shitty Chinese food place? Do you have like orange chicken or sweet and sour chicken? Are those options?
Yeah. I mess with the honey garlic chicken as well.
Honey garlic?
Ginger beef. Yeah. Well,
okay.
You know.
Ginger beef. Yeah, but you've never heard of General Tso's, General Tao's. It's like a lot of different.
See, I feel like.
Have you heard of a General Blank chicken?
I'm thinking no, I haven't. And I'm thinking that you just have lower quality Chinese food.
Well, it's an American standard, and by that nature, yes, it is probably lower quality.
Well, see, now we're getting to the heart of the matter here.
There we are.
You eat crap.
But you do have like sweet and sour chicken, so that's not true. Because all of these are standards.
Well, I know it's all like the bootleg versions. I'm aware of that. I'm aware of that reality.
Yeah, yours is like, I can't make a joke without it being messed up, so I'm not going to.
Okay, let's not be problematic. Let's avoid that. We're of course deep diving into Larry Nance being robbed in the dunk contest, right?
Oh, that poor guy. Well, here's the thing. So his first dunk wasn't very good. I'll say it.
His dunks all looked a lot better in slow motion.
Yeah, and I said that right away out in the first one. But the problem with recreating dunks, which he did with two of his four, because like the beneath the basket windmill is Vince special, right?
Yeah. It was very, very similar to the Vince behind the backboard one, too.
Yeah. Like it's sweet, but like it's not as sweet as when Vince did it because we'd never seen it before. And
right. But it was closer to what Vince did. And like it was super athletic and far away from the basket. It was a lot closer than what Mitchell did.
Yeah, Mitchell's was not even so much worse looking.
He should be allowed in Canada. And as the authority on those type of matters, I think I have the ability to prevent him from entering this country ever again as a result of that.
Yeah, you're a powerful man. You'll shut off his water, so to speak. yeah, it was interesting. A lot of people were all salty about Dennis Smith not making it to the finals, but it was like, and yeah, his dunk was the best of the night, but like that first dunk was ass.
Yeah, that dunk was crazy good. It should have got him in anyways.
The real problem here is that where a good dunk is an 8, a great dunk is a 9, and a perfect dunk is a 10. And like,
unless you're DJ Khaled, and then it's just completely arbitrary.
My point is that the grading scale is just like a little warped upwards, so like they don't have the room to bone it. Like I think Nance had all 50s on one of his dunks too. Or all 10s on one of his dunks, too. And it's like, that dunk was not as good as Dennis Smith's dunk.
No.
It was a fun contest. People who get worked up about who wins a dunk contest can go be miserable somewhere else. Because it was fine. It was fun.
Well, that's what Twitter's for. So I don't think you can really, like, shame people for being miserable and choosing to be miserable on Twitter. Because,
point.
Like... That is what that forum is for. And like that's where you tell somebody when they're bitching about it in real life. You're like, oh, just go bitch about it on Twitter.
That's fair. So it's really on me for being on Twitter in the first place. But it was a fun contest, I thought. And then the game was actually fun. And LeBron won MVP, which was cool. Kyrie passed to LeBron for like the game-winning layup, which hurt my soul. But
game. See, this is all part of the plan. And like just like when LeBron left in 2015, it was really a plan with Dan Gilbert to help refill the cupboard, get assets and get another shot at it back in 2014. That was the plan from day one. This was a plan to destroy the Celtics assets and then have Kyrie return after next season. So
hashtag La Familia.
Yeah. Hashtag La Familia clutch. all that good stuff. Even though Kyrie's not clutch, he's still a part of La Familia.
He's clutch.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a fun game. It was one of the nice things about like a good competitive All-Star game is you can actually like kind of have some fun reading into some stuff, like kind of who each guy considers an alpha dog, who looks comfortable playing with other really good players. Like Giannis looked pretty uncomfortable playing off ball, and he wasn't going to play on ball with Steph and Harden out there. And then like you had someone like Embiid who like so very much looked the part in a way that was like, it was encouraging in a way that like it obviously doesn't matter, but he definitely looked like he belonged out there.
Do you think Kevin Love like called into LeBron when he's defending Steph on that last possession and be like, no, he's going to try to over dribble and get a shot. He's not going to drive to the basket. You can be extra aggressive on him.
I think, I think Kevin Durant might have known that too when they just gave him the trap from hell. Curry just weirdly dribbled into the sideline.
Now, did Kevin Durant know that? Or like organically know that from being around Steph, or was that something he learned from Jay Crowder when he met with Boston and was gifted with the keys to beating the Warriors?
Oh man, I really thought we were going to be done slandering Jay Crowder on the pod, but I am happy to be back. Yeah,
were rejuvenated.
Yeah, their system was to try to stop them from scoring, something that Tyronn Lue apparently never taught him how to do. But we should probably move past All-Star talk because that's probably a little old at this point anyway. We have just one more day off by the time this posts. Cavs play on Thursday against the Wizards. The final third or so of the season is here. What are you looking forward to seeing the most? What is your biggest anxiety?
I think life in general is my biggest anxiety.
From a basketball perspective, perhaps.
Oh, okay. I thought we were opening up. You know, we've had this podcast running for a while. I thought maybe we're just sharing. Okay.
Yeah, well, you know I'm not that emotionally vulnerable.
It's true. I guess right now, the biggest concern is basically once Kevin Love does return, how he integrates himself into the lineup. He put the timetable at about a month from All-Star, so that would be in kind of a late to mid-March return. So he's going to have time, but if Kevin Love isn't 100% and he isn't himself, as we discussed before, that just like you need that second offensive hub, and there is no alternative now. Like Kevin Love needs to be an All-Star star caliber player and play at that level if he's going to have any hope of like relieving LeBron and managing that workload, because we know LeBron can win a series on his own and he can get through those tough battles, but the cumulative effect of it, especially in an improved East, you just want to have him as fresh as possible. And if Love isn't himself, I think that's going to be a concern for the team.
Yeah, I think there's something to that. I mean, his usage was really, really high in the first two games with the revamped roster. And that's not quite fair because you do have to account very importantly for the fact that one of those games he put up 37 points and was chucking in a good way, but he was chucking. He was a lot more low usage in the other game as Clarkson and Hood and even Hill was a little bit more aggressive in that one.
Plus his will to live was restored, so he wanted to kind of show off a little bit.
Yeah, and I mean, he was on fire, so it was fun. So I wouldn't read too much into that, but I do think Love is a really important one. My big concern here is, who's the odd man out looking forward? The Cavs have 11 guys they want to play right now. And while they don't have to play everyone anymore, because they excise most of the terrible egos on their roster, they still have, like, I mean, do they really want to DNP Kyle Korver?
No.
Do they really want to DNP Jeff Green? Like, and that's
you
not
know
even,
who it's going to be, though, right?
It's probably going to be. I thought it'd be Jetty, but they don't seem that interested in it.
It's going to be Jetty. Like when Love returns and Love starts at power forward, LeBron's going to slide over to small forward, and those minutes, like Jetty being kind of. In a way, kind of like the Jose Calderon in that starting lineup. Like he's a placeholder. He's not going to do anything that's going to hurt the team. He brings energy, and he's been great in that role. But I think once Love returns to the starting lineup and he gets bumped out of there, I think he gets forgotten, because that bench, assuming the bench continues to play as well as it has, I think Lou's going to keep that together. And traditionally, he's wanted to kind of go away from younger players. And I just don't see, even with Jetty playing as well as he is, I think he's going to be the odd man out. It's either him or Jeff Green, right?
Yeah, I mean, and I think Lou just loves Green. And Green is actually something we've talked about a little bit, but I wouldn't mind touching back on, is the fact that Green really struggled playing alongside Tristan Thompson on those bench units, didn't really have the spacing to be the cutter and in the dunker position. But the Cavs have been really using Larry Nance out of that high post as a passer early on, and that's something he seems really comfortable doing. And that's allowed Green to actually play well in the minutes next to Nance, even though Nance is also a non-shooter. So I think if they're able to continue to leverage Nance's passing ability, Green is going to play just fine. I thought for a while, I thought he would be the natural casualty if he was going to struggle like he did along Tristan, where he would have to play next to a true center at all times. I think Green is pretty much locked in this place. So the one name that we're not mentioning that I think Twitter will want us to mention is Tristan Thompson. And I think ultimately how many minutes Tristan Thompson, Larry Nance get and how those minutes are divvied will very much be determined by the
matchup.
Not just matchups, is determined by how much Tyronn Lue wants to use Kevin Love at center.
Because
if he's being used at center, I think they're going to have a hard time finding minutes for all three.
Yeah. The interesting thing is, like, even if Love is playing technically at center, I can see a lot of those minutes coming with Nance, because Nance has that athleticism and the ability to cover for him. So even if he's playing center offensively, I think Nance would be covering for him and playing center, the de facto center on the defensive end of the floor. That is interesting, and I agree that how much Love is playing at center is going to factor in. It really is nice, though, when you have three guys in Love, Nance, and Thompson that just are going to hit the boards like crazy. Because that's one thing that the Cavs really missed, was that rebounding big off the bench. And having three guys that can really attack the glass, create extra possessions. I mean, Nance has already blown me away. I don't know if he's going to consistently play at this high level, but like all the little things, his ability to get boards, like that's something he's done consistently throughout his career. And I'm just so excited for what these lineups can be, what this roster can be. And as we said before, it's really going to be an opportunity for Tyronn Lue to show what he can do when you have a competent rotation and a lot of different looks that you can throw at teams.
Yeah, I agree. I think they do have a lot of options, and figuring out these lineup combinations that are going to work are really going to be important. I think I'm interested in seeing what this Cavs team looks like when they're not shooting the cover off the ball. Like, they have good shooters, sure, but they've been shooting the ball at an outrageous rate right now, I think it's fair to say.
Yeah, that's probably fair to say. I don't know if Jordan Clarkson is going to be a 57% three-point shooter for the rest of the year.
You technically cannot rule it out.
That's what Boston was banking on with Jason Tatum, so why can't we bank on it with Clarkson?
That's a great point. He's probably a Hall of Famer too, actually, now that you think about it.
15-time All-Star.
When you look at, that is a pairing, you mentioned it, but I kind of wanted to go back to it. The Love-Nance pairing, I feel like, has a ton of potential offensively to be really fun. Being able to use Nance as an off-ball screener while Love distributes out of the high post, or even kind of running some of that action that Channing Frye and Kyle Korver used to run for each other on the weak side with Love and LeBron.
Yeah.
Or even the Kyle Korver, Jeff Green play that results in an open layup or a foul for Green every time he slips that screen. Like, you can do that and use Nance's ability as a passer in the high post while leveraging Love's shooting strengths in a really effective way. They have a lot of options right now. It's more about just the ceiling. I do want to see kind of what happens when they need to win a shootout. And let's say LeBron's not having his best game. What does that look like? But because I'm still worried about the overall offensive upside of this team. I'm worried that role players are going to turn into pumpkins in the postseason. But that, I mean, that's really not a huge concern until they get to the finals. I'm not that worried about any of these teams in the East with this rebuilt roster. Is that fair for you?
Yeah, that is fair for me. And like, it's as long as they get through the East comfortably, like I think that's a good pitch to LeBron, because then you still have that Nets pick available. There's still a lot of things that you can do. And I think that's going to build confidence moving forward. As you said, it is concerning not having that second elite wing scoring option, because I think that's something that the Cavs need to add at some point. I think Love can help you out a lot, and it's been encouraging that he has played well against Golden State this year, even without kind of a Kyrie or a good Isaiah Thomas to distract the defense. Like, Love has still been able to get his against the Warriors, and that's important. But yeah, you're going to need guys like Rodney Hood to actually play really well. And Hood has scored at a high volume, and he's scored as kind of the focal point of a lot of the defenses, because Utah, just outside of Donovan Mitchell, they don't have another kind of explosive option offensively. Unless it's one of those weird nights where Ricky Rubio hits a million threes and Zach Harper loses his mind. which, trust me, those games are fun, but they're just not consistently there. So, yeah, there's going to need to be those guys stepping up. But ultimately, it's not something I'm too concerned about, because the variance between what those role guys will contribute when they're playing really well and when they play like crap, I just don't think that matters a whole lot against the Warriors, because they're just that much better than the Cavs.
It's a great point.
You're not beating them, no, unless there's injuries.
Yeah, unless you have someone banged up on the fringe where you can say, maybe. I mean, I will say that if you're making the case for we should actually be worried about the Warriors, which, stop, only Warriors fans, because nobody else is. But if you're making that case, you do point to the fact that the Warriors aren't getting anything out of their top four other than from their top four. I mean, all their role players are underperforming this year. And if that trend holds and the Cavaliers get a ton of help three through nine, then, you know, you could make the case some good stuff could happen. But I mean, still a pretty outrageous long shot.
I definitely think that there's the possibility of a really good series there. Like, George Hill is someone that has played good defense on Steph, and our defenders on this team. It's all about developing the chemistry in time. I think that's something that, in order to really, for this roster to really challenge a team like the Warriors, you'd need like a full season of chemistry, and then you kind of need to mock up the game, which I think they can do. But like, you see teams with a strong defensive identity, like the Memphis Grizzlies, that can kind of punch above their weight against the Warriors. And I think the Cavs have some of that personnel, but it's guys that haven't done that consistently throughout their career. This is a new roster that's going to only be together for a few weeks before the playoffs. Like, there's just too many factors there. I definitely agree with you that if you have one of those series where one of their two stars there really like struggles and role players aren't playing well, the Cavs are playing above their head, sure, you can definitely make it an extended series.
Yeah. Moving back to the East, the Cavs currently
Not jump into a finals. Yeah.
The Cavs are 6.5 games back of the one seed. I think it's fair to write that one off. They are just four games even back from the two seed. Celtics are obviously reeling, but they have had the All-Star break to regroup a little bit. Where did the Cavs finish in the Eastern Conference by the end of the year?
I'm going to say they finish second, because I think Boston is in a little bit of a tailspin. And I think a lot of what's made them good this year just wasn't sustainable. I can also see Stevens cutting back on minutes for guys and resting them even more so than they already are. But I wouldn't be surprised if they just kind of held on to third. because there is going to be a bit of a lull, and yeah, it's tough. And I think the Cavs schedule is fairly easy, but it all comes down to basically how they survive that 6-game road trip, which will be before Kevin Love comes back.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it matters. I don't think everything's ideal for the Cavs right now. And
did I flip-flop a lot in that rant.
That's okay. I'm looking forward to see. I'm not looking forward to it because obviously it's never fun when your team doesn't play well, but I am interested to see what this Cavs team looks like when they hit a little adversity. We just kind of, you know, it's just not something we've gotten to see with these new guys yet. And everything's fun and good times are rolling right now, but will LeBron kind of bail on these guys if a couple of them go through an extended poor stretch of play? We know his standards are really, really high. We know not everyone's capable of cutting that. And it'll just be interesting to see. I want to see what this team looks like when things aren't going perfectly, because right now things have gone just about as well as we could ask them to go, right?
Yeah, that's definitely fair. I mean, is there going to be like a Jordan Clarkson, Deion Waiters moment or something like that? Like, there's definitely the potential for that when shots aren't falling for everybody. But I don't know. Like, the one thing that I think is in the Cavs' favor is that these pieces make sense and they fit. Like, I think it's one thing when you have a few awkward pieces that you've been trying to make work, and when those individual parts are playing well, you win games. That's one thing, and you can look at it and be like, okay, well, how sustainable is this? But when it's just a matter of whether or not guys make shots, like, I think as long as they play well and they make the right decisions, LeBron's going to be able to live with that. I don't think that this is a roster where you have guys that are going to be hijacking the offense and doing things that really make him frustrated. Like, I think he can live with a missed shot, if that makes sense.
I think that's fair. And at the very least, they do have much better defensive personnel where they can kind of go through some lulls offensively where they just really couldn't afford it. I mean, that was Mike Zavagno, FDS writer's consistent point on Twitter during that horrible December or late December or January and early January malaise. Was it's like, yeah, they're allowing an insane amount of points, but they were like putting up like 96-0 ratings in those games. Like, they couldn't score, they couldn't shoot. And
right.
Like, sure, that stinks, but like the Cavs at least can weather like a bad offensive night in a way that they couldn't before.
How good do you think this team is going to be defensively down the stretch? Because, like, I think, I mean, this is extreme small sample size, but, like, over the last three games there since the trade, I think they were, like, at, like, 14th in defensive efficiency over that stretch. And, like, the numbers were fine, but they were also playing teams that weren't good offensively. Like, the Atlanta Hawks, terrible team. Boston Celtics, bad offensive team. OKC is a mediocre offensive team. Like, do you think that those numbers are going to be like respectable down the stretch, or do you think we're going to see a little blip where it's fine, and then ultimately the overall numbers still aren't great?
I think it's fair to hope that this team settles in around like 17th to 20th in defensive rating.
We got high standards here
in the second half of the season. I think that's fair. You know, the scheme is still tough, man. They're still doing all this trapping at the point of attack and playing 4-on-3 a lot on defense. And like, I don't know. It's funny every time the Cavs, and I don't know if you've picked up on this, every time the Cavs have like struggled for a prolonged period on defense, then they'll have like 3-4 good games. And Tyronn Lue will say, yeah, we just decided to simplify everything. It's like, well, maybe right. Just ghost more simple more often, because I think your guys are a little confused. Like, I don't know. The trapping just doesn't really do it for me, man.
I think that's an interesting takeaway, and I think that was something they discussed on Open Floor as well. Of are we just like overthinking NBA offenses? Like, would we be better off if we just simplified things and stuck with the pick and roll and sets like that? Like, I think there's something to just how good the Cavs played when they're really not going deep into a playbook and they're just kind of playing basketball.
Well, yeah, I mean, I was talking about the defensive end, to be clear, but on the
No, I know, but it just made me think of something I wanted to talk about.
I mean, on the offensive end, that's, I mean, David Zavac, our friend, wrote a nice piece about that for The Athletic, where he kind of just talked about how, you know, and this has always been the thing, and I think the Cavs have taught us, or, you know, if anyone's trying to learn lessons, which it doesn't seem like basketball Twitter's ever that interested in doing that, but if you're trying to learn lessons and you're open-minded, the Cavs have really taught you that there's a lot of paths up the mountain on offense. And, you know, it's, you don't have to run this beautiful motion offense where guys are setting split cuts and doing all these flare screens. Like, sometimes it's a high pick and roll that's well-spaced where guys are moving into the right empty spaces. Like,
especially with LeBron. Like, he draws so much attention and he can make so many reads. Like, you have sets to, like, get guys open and to kind of promote movement. But you got intelligent players that can read and react. And I think Lou would be well-served to actually do that. And I know you've wanted Kevin Love to get a lot of looks that we even saw Nance get in the last couple games.
Yeah, I mean, that's all doable. Are you a Parks and Rec guy?
I am.
So do you remember the episode where Chris Traeger, played by Rob Lowe, is he's trying to like get the department to be healthier, so he's trying to get like beef burgers out of the cafeteria, so he has like a cook-off with Ron Swanson, and he goes and gets this crazy vegan burger with these this beautiful toppings and fresh produce and all this stuff, and and he just puts together this amazing veggie burger, and they like it, and then Swanson just hands them a regular cheeseburger and says you can have some ketchup with it if you want, and they all prefer that. That's kind of the offense.
100% beef.
Yeah. Like, just give me the meat, man. It's fine. And no one turned that into a drop or something. I don't know. It just seems to make sense to go simple more often than not. Let LeBron make reads. It's not the same. People think, I mean, it goes back to the thing we've talked about before. People think pick and roll offense is isolation offense if the guy who is running the pick and roll shoots. Have you noticed that? Like, people are like, ISO ball again. It's like, well, you ran pick and roll and then got a switch with their center on their point guard. I think that's okay. Like,
yeah, and like that was one thing that Cavs did so well was that they ran those Tyree LeBron pick and rolls, pick and pops, and like it just always generated a mismatch. Like, LeBron was on a point guard or Kyrie is being guarded by a forward, and like both of those were really favorable matchups where Kyrie and LeBron could score at will. Like, it doesn't have to be rocket science.
No, and sometimes you're going out of your way to create offense just to pretend like you have a good motion offense, and then you're turning the ball over a lot. Like, one of my favorite examples was those ISO Joe Hawks.
Mm-hmm.
Almost always had like a top 10 offensive rating, despite having the most hideous shooting clogged offense that you could find, because they didn't pass, so they didn't turn the ball over. I mean, that's always been the thing with Kyrie, where people just hate that they feel like he hogs the ball, but like, dude doesn't turn the ball over. That matters.
Hey man, Brad Stevens, he gets open shots for Marcus Smart, man.
Yeah, that's awesome.
It's beautiful.
Yeah, cool. Like, it's just not that good of offense if it generates. I mean, it's Matt Moore was talking about it on Twitter. It's not that good of offense.
I don't want to be a dick. Brad Stevens is a great coach.
Of course he's a great coach, but it's like...
But yeah.
But like,
those players are open for a reason, and they should know better than to shoot.
Yeah, of course. And like, I don't know, like, even like the guys on the Celtics feel like they have this like green light that... Like, could you imagine if Draymond Green had the green light that Marcus Smart has?
Like, I mean, that is the reason why Steve Kerr doesn't let the players coach every game, because Draymond would be taking 9 threes a game.
Yeah, like that matters that he doesn't.
And yelling that he's not a robot after each shot.
Yeah, like, you need that balance. You need to tell a guy to not chuck. Like, Marcus Smart, like, will take like 9 threes in a playoff game. Like, I'm sorry, that's just like, that can't happen.
And that fucking guy beat us.
Yeah, I mean, whatever.
No, that bothers me the same way. Like, Ray for Alston and that Magic brutal team and all those.
It can't bother you the same way.
No. Honestly, it almost does, because I'm not even going to get into it. It's not healthy for me. I'm trying to live with more positivity in my life, so let's avoid it.
I'm proud of you, pal.
Thank you. Yeah, but moral of the story, Marcus Smart shouldn't be taking 9 threes a game.
No, he
should not.
That's
probably only happened like once in his career, if it's ever happened, but
hey,
this is our argument.
This has probably been the best thing for Marcus Smart stands. Somehow those exist in the world just because they've fallen apart without him. Because he went full Amari Stoudemire and punched a wall or something.
Is he going to get a big contract from them, like, as a result of the stretch?
I don't know. Danny Ainge tried to trick everyone into taking his stuff. I developed a really good theory with my good friend Cameron about Brad Stevens and about kind of how we've talked about how, you know, Isaiah looked so good with him, then was unplayable. Jay Crowder, so good with the Celtics, now is unplayable. And then Avery Bradley, so good with the Celtics, not good. Like, all these guys that just, like, leave Boston and then just suck. And we decided that people's, like, first instinct is to say that, wow, Brad Stevens must be a very good coach. But we developed an alternate theory. I think he's a con artist. Because these guys, they don't play well when they leave, but also they don't play well in the playoffs for the most part either. So it's this regular season snake oil salesman we've got here. And of course these guys have attitudes when they leave. Brad Stevens has been lying to them and tricking them into thinking they're good for 4 years. That's cruel.
I don't hate this theory.
It's really not bad. It's like they're people who, like, in like the 1800s, who were sold like a hair regrowth tonic. That's mostly just oil, and then their hair doesn't grow back, and they get pissed. They've been lied to, man. It's not fair. He's a con artist.
I mean, you can't feel too great about it, because part of the con was making Isaiah Thomas look like a star player and that being part of a package for Kyrie.
No, Brad Stevens should feel great. He's like,
Stevens should feel great.
Yeah, to go back to another Mike Schur show reference, it's when Dwight is at they're doing like the garage sale at the company, and Dwight tries to go from like a thumbtack up to a telescope. He's just trading garbage all the way into something good. Once again, con artist.
The legacy of Isaiah Thomas right there.
The legacy of Brad Stevens. Our country's greatest liar.
We have to name the podcast. This episode has to be labeled Brad Stevens, our country's greatest liar. No real explanation.
Yeah, if you want to find out, you'll have to make it, you know, like 32 minutes pod. I think it's a really strong theory.
I really like it. I appreciate what you're doing with that.
Yeah, Cameron is my best workshop dumb basketball theories friend. And I think he did great work.
That's going to be really hurtful for Sam Esfandiari.
Well, yeah, he'll have to deal with it. He's a sensitive soul.
Yeah. He's got the whole news cage thing going on, and yeah, that's going to be a blow to the ego for poor Sam.
He'll get over it.
What are your realistic expectations for the Cavs kind of down the stretch here?
I don't know.
I know we kind of touched on this with the seeding, but like, do you like expect a strong finish? Or
yeah, I think I do, just because LeBron is reinvigorated in a way and surrounded by pieces that actually make sense for him. And to go back to my friend Cameron, because he actually said something really smart, and we talked about this a week or so ago.
Man, why don't I just host this with him?
Well, he's a lot smarter than me, so that probably would work. But we were talking
well, that's
about,
just going to make me look bad too. So,
well, when you looked at the Cavs roster this summer, they really tried to get a lot of guys that almost are in the Golden State role player mold. These guys who were a little bit jack of all tradesy, and Jeff Green and Dwayne Wade, like guys who could kind of do a lot of different things. The kind of role players that say the Warriors typically go for.
Okay.
But then really you look at the role players who have thrived with LeBron. It's always been guys who are A++ at one thing and a strong, like, I don't know, C minus at everything else, as opposed to someone like Steph Curry or on the Warriors, where really, like, you want Curry surrounded by B's across the boards, jacks of all trades, masters of none, because he's the specialist, right?
Right.
And Cameron, my friend, made a really good point. He said, LeBron likes chess, and chess is all about learning specializations for special pieces on the board and specifically how to use those. And that's LeBron in a lot of ways. So when you look at this team, they're chock full of specialists. You have Rodney Hood, a shooter specialist with some length on the defensive end. You've got George Hill, a shooting specialist with length on defensive end. You've got Larry Nance, who's an athlete and hustle play guy. He's got all of these guys are really single-minded and single-skilled for the most part. I think Jordan Clarkson's probably the biggest diversion from that in being a volume scorer off the bench with a bit of a shaky jumper. But everyone else are really specialists.
Now, if we're sticking with the chess analogy, does that make Jetty Osmond the queen?
I think that makes Kevin the queen because he's versatile. Actually, no. Who's the most underappreciated piece on the chessboard? I'm going to go with the rook. Kevin's the rook, and Jetty's the knight.
He's a little wild,
but he's valuable. But I just think when you look at this team, it is full of these chess pieces that LeBron likes to play with traditionally, and the guys that he's excelled with traditionally. Maybe that means they have a lower ceiling overall, but it is the kind of team that historically he's been able to have a lot of success with, especially in the regular season. I mean, people like to think that LeBron's just been punting regular seasons his whole career. He used to win 65, 67 games with the Cavs.
Yeah, and that was like with Mo Williams, Anthony Parker, Mario Moon, J.J. Hickson.
Yep.
Z.
So there are more options than people think in terms of like their ability to finish the season strong. And I really am looking forward to seeing kind of where this team goes, because I think it's a lot different than any team we've seen in the LeBron return era.
Yeah, I think there's the definite possibility that this looks a lot like the close to 2015. I mean, the kind of wild card is not having Kevin Love, and there's just not those same kind of reliable options around LeBron. But like, LeBron was completely rejuvenated after the trades, getting J.R. Smith, getting Mozgov, getting all those guys. And like the Cavs, just because it wasn't something that was established and they were trying to figure out how to play with one another, like LeBron was working on that, and he was trying, as you said, to figure out how to best utilize all the pieces around him. And I think there's the definite possibility of that down the stretch. And I think I saw, like, I think the Cavs have like the eighth easiest schedule remaining.
Oh, that's good to see.
So that's certainly helpful. I mean, that January and February stretch really made things worse than it already was. And like, it was kind of the perfect storm. So I think that there's the possibility that how they finish looks better than what it actually is, but that's fine because they need the confidence. They need to kind of get rolling in that direction. Even if some of it, I guess we're just quoting stuff, but like, to quote The Wire, like, if it's a lie, we fight on that lie. Like, just keep it going, and like, keep the confidence going. And when Love returns, you got a few weeks to figure that out, and then just go into the playoffs, and you'll have a confidence booster likely in the first round, and you just kind of ride that wave.
Yeah, if you're looking for Parks and Rec, The Office, and The Wire references in one episode, we're your guys. I did want to move to a little bit of a rapid fire kind of game where I kind of want to get your first thought reactions, because I was thinking about this team, and something that's nice about all the depth is that they have a lot of different options for lineup combinations, I think it's fair to say. So I'm going to run through potential challenges for the Cavs in the playoffs, and I want you to tell me their best five against each of these teams.
I really like this.
Kind of the five that they should close with against each team. So let's start with the Boston Celtics.
Okay. So you're just saying like the
regular Celtics? Best lineup.
That
they'll close games with.
Tristan Thompson, Kevin Love, LeBron, Hood, and Hill.
Yep, I think that's fair. I think that you're going to be able to batter them when they try to go small with Love in the post. Tristan Thompson will continue to be Al Horford's father.
And I also think that you can close with Nats in there instead of Thompson, because Love individually has done well on Horford as well. Mm-hmm. I think he was a little outmatched playing center defensively there. But individually, he's done a really good job on Horford. And I think Nats, especially when you have Marcus Morris out there and guys that you can't, like, you don't even have to really worry about, it lets Nance play free safety. LeBron can play a little bit of free safety, and that's what you need to contain Kyrie, because with any elite point guard, it's a team effort, even though George Hill can do a good job individually.
For sure. So let's move on, after touching on the Celtics, to the other Eastern Conference challenger, the Toronto Raptors.
The Raptors are interesting because I don't know if they end up sticking with their lineup. Like they've consistently done one thing in the regular season, and then Jonas just kind of craps the bed and they change it up. So if they're going with Ibaka at the five, that would obviously change things. Here's the interesting thing. Like, when we were talking about how they match up against these East rosters, none of these teams are good enough that the Cavs should change what they do and whatever's worked best. Like, they should just go with that, and the other team should be forced to adjust. Like, I think it becomes interesting when you talk about going against the Warriors and the death lineup and things like that. But, like, I think your best five is still Hill, Hood, LeBron, Love, and Thompson, assuming Tristan's playing well.
I'm going to throw a little curveball at you. Last year, they really did well not using Love that heavily against the Raptors. He was something of a decoy. And actually, I kind of like LeBron at the four against the Raptors, because they have nothing to do. They have no counter for that.
Yeah, but the thing is, like, I get that, and it worked. But, like, the Cavs had, like, a crazy shooting series against the Raptors. And, like, even Kyrie wasn't shooting well, but I think he averaged over 10 assists per game in the series. And I think from a matchup standpoint, having Love and LeBron out there, that's two guys that the Raptors don't have a defender for. Like, I think Siakam can kind of hang with him a little bit on the perimeter, but he can't deal with him on the inside, and he gets lost with Love's off-ball movement. And like Ibaka, like I don't think that's going to present a huge threat. He's fallen off defensively, so I just think having two guys out there where it's, okay, well, what do we do with this guy defensively? Like, if that's the question Casey's asking himself, that's what you want. Like, I think Toronto is going to actually be a challenge, and that's a series that's going to go six, in my opinion. Like a legitimate six, not what it was a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. But I do think Love needs to be a part of winning that series.
I do think there is something to the extent of, like, yeah, they didn't need Love as much back last year, but they had Kyrie then. And this is a fundamentally different team, so I think you do have a good point.
And they also
there.
Had Fry, who was like death
Fry
for
was
the Raptors.
Shot the lights out in that series. He was awesome.
So maybe you use Love a little bit more like
maybe
Fry
at the five.
In that series. Yeah.
Maybe use him at the five in kind of the way that you used Fry the year prior. And
as you said, they don't have an answer for LeBron at the four. So
no,
if you have both of those guys, if you have those two guys as your two bigs, quote unquote, and you surround that with long shooters, like I think that becomes a problem for Toronto.
I agree. It's honestly a really good spot for them. And I think the Raptors are still going to have a really hard time matching up. And the Cavs are really aided by having a couple extra long defenders that they haven't had in the past to throw on Lowry and DeRozan. So yep. Let's move to the West for potential finals matchups. Let's move over to the Warriors.
Okay. Oh, boy. Now, are we going to say against the Warriors starters or who they're actually going to play when it matters?
Who they're actually going to play when it matters. And sometimes that means David West. Sometimes that means Draymond at the five. They don't go to the death lineup without fail down the stretch. I think that's fair to say. Kerr's traditionalist nature cuts against that a little bit, I think.
I think from a game-to-game basis, you look at how Love's doing, because there were games in the finals where he was really effective no matter who was out there, and the team did well when he was out there. But if you can tell it's one of those games where he's just not going to be effective, I think he's at the point in his career, and he's demonstrated this, where he's okay kind of taking a back seat.
I agree.
And in those instances, I would like to see Nance at the five, LeBron at the four, Hood at the three, JR along with Hill. Assuming
that is the correct answer, that I will not accept. I wouldn't have accepted any other answer if Love's not running well. I think that's 100% spot on. I think Nance's ability on switches and his ability to create deflections, I think specifically, he's one of the best deflection creating centers in the NBA per tracking data. Mm-hmm. And I think that part of beating the Warriors is winning the possession game. And part of winning the possession game is turning them the hell over. The Cavs have had a harder and harder time turning teams over in the past couple of years. And all of a sudden, they have all this extra wingspan. And I think that's something that when we've seen the Thunder do well against the Warriors this year, that's something they're really, really strong at, is they got three or four guys who are capable of playing free safety and jumping passing lanes when Kerr is being a little too dead set on running his beautiful motion offense. That when you really can learn their sets and really internalize them, you have a really good shot to cause problems there.
Yep. Nance is a really good fit against the Warriors, in my opinion.
I would agree.
Because he brings so much of what you love with Thompson. Like, he brings the offensive rebounding. He's even more mobile and versatile. And for as much as I've defended Tristan, and I think he's rounding into form, and that's great for the Cavs, because at this point you want as much internal growth as possible, and he's just someone that's consistently worked well for this team. Mm-hmm. I'm okay with Nance taking over for him and really blossoming. I always thought it was funny when people would try to replace him with like Jack Cooley and Ante Zizic and whoever else has been thrown into the mix here. Like, Larry Nance is a legitimate option, and there's real reasons to believe that would work. So I wish that there was one game left this regular season against the Warriors, because I would love to kind of get a sample going in. But it is fun to be able to throw a team that they've never played before at them. I think there's some value in that.
Yeah, and also it's just worth noting that something that the Warriors have done a really nice job at is force Tristan Thompson to finish over them, and they'll trap
and Nance
they'll
has
trap
no
the
problem
wing.
Getting up into the rafters.
Oh yeah, and Nance can just get up to that second level in a way that they can't, that Tristan can't. If they go meet Tristan a step outside of the paint on the short roll after they trap the ball handler, he just doesn't really have that next play where Nance seems a little bit more comfortable taking a dribble, making a secondary pass, or, as we've seen in the past, just yamming on folks.
Yeah, he's a brick shithouse with jet packs attached to him.
Yep, and finally, against the Houston Rockets. Not that I think either of us expect that to happen, but in the interest of being thorough.
Okay, so the first thing you want to make sure is that the players are ready to avoid the areas where Paul and Harden defecate themselves in the NBA Finals, because you don't want that on your shoes. You're going to get sprains. You might pull a groin if it slips. Outside of that, I think you want a lot of length there. So obviously you're going with Hill. Man, do you just go the Hill, Hood, LeBron, Love, and Thompson?
I think this is another one where you have to get a read on Love. This is a team that really makes you move in a similar way that the Rockets do. And they have two guys who are really, really good killers in isolation, and Paul and Harden. And I think the last thing you want to see is to see them consistently generating switches with Love.
Mm-hmm.
So I think this is another one where you have to kind of read the room, so to speak, see how Love's handling it, see if he's moving well that day, see if he's beating them on the other end, because I do sense them kind of going smaller and smaller. I think they've kicked Ryan Anderson out of that starting lineup. So if they've got someone like PJ Tucker and or Trevor Ariza at the four, you have a distinct advantage on that end. And
yeah,
you have to let Love win that matchup based on the current roster construction.
Yeah, so, man, as great as the Rockets have been, and I think that they are the second best team in the league this year, it's just not a matchup I think about, because I just believe that the Warriors team is that good. And like they're running at like 55-60%, and they're still this good. And I have to believe that second gear is there. But if Houston does find a way to kind of catch them sleeping, because we know how tough it is to repeatedly make the finals. It's something that's super rare and a testament to how good LeBron's been on whatever team he's on. But if they find a way to pull off an upset, even though I think Houston's the better team, I think the Cavs would have a realistic shot if they are firing on all cylinders.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure how Vegas would handicap it. I'm sure they'd have the Rockets as favorites, but I would really trust in the Cavs, because I think they would have by far the best player on the floor over the course of that series, where you just don't get that luxury against the Warriors. Where even if LeBron's great,
they have the second and third best player.
And also the second and third best players can be the better player on a game to game basis.
Yeah, or for a series.
Even if LeBron plays well. Whereas if LeBron's playing his best, I don't think anyone's touching him in a Rockets series.
Paul's going to come after you.
Well, I don't care. He's 20. No, he's not. He's 19.
Yeah. Shout out to Bobby Hill. Well, this is probably a good place to wrap. We actually managed to get content out, even though there's been absolutely nothing really occurred other than an All-Star game. So I credit you, segment producer Carter.
Oh, thank you. That's what I demanded you call me. And I think that I earned that name.
Well, I inverted it. You said Carter, segment producer.
Oh.
And I wanted to just kind of bring you down just a little bit by not delivering it in the right way.
Mission not accomplished.
Perfect. Anyways, I will try. As I botch that, I will try to botch this ending. So thanks again to all our listeners. Remember, support the show. We really do appreciate all the feedback you guys give us. If you feel so inclined, leave a review. It's really, really helpful. Ratings also very helpful. Subscribe, unsubscribe, resubscribe. Help cook those books. So thanks again, you guys. And until next time, go Cavs. World.